broadcasting from the UNMC College of Nursing. Get ready for RN Huddle, the podcast dedicated to bringing hot topics for and by nurses to the table.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in to RN Huddle. This is your host, Heidi Keeler, coming to you from Omaha, Nebraska, UNMC College of Nursing. And I am so excited that you decided to tune in with us today. We have a very special and exciting episode. And this episode, we're going to turn it over to our co-host and ensure that you have an amazing experience learning more about this topic. So without further ado, welcome to RN Huddle and this week's episode.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, the NPIAP Pressure Injuries, Facts and Fantasies podcast. My guest for this session is Catherine Cheadle. Ms. Cheadle is a defense attorney in a law firm here in Omaha, and her task is to defend us against lawsuits. So obviously what we're going to talk about is lawsuits that involve pressure injuries. So I'll have Catherine introduce herself in just a second. I'm going to go to the mailbox. You know, that's what I do first in these things. So here's the mailbox. Can a deep tissue pressure injury evolve into a stage 2 pressure injury? I know that they can just go away or evolve into full thickness, but can they actually evolve into stage 2? And if they can, do I have any data to support that? So this was an interesting question because we believe that deep tissue injury is damage to the muscle and the muscle is pressed against the underlying bone. And because we believe that to be true, it really could not be a stage 2 because stage 2s don't involve tissue that deep. So my answer was no, I don't believe they can evolve into a stage 2, except in pediatrics. There are kids that have deep tissue injuries on Friday, and by Monday, they're completely gone. And of course, in the adult world, that wouldn't happen. So I'd be interested if any of you have the experience of deep tissue injury evolving into a very superficial wound without treatment. I understood this question to be without treatment. Then how do you think that that can be happening? So that was the mailbox question. So now let me turn to our guest for this podcast. Can I call you Katie? I think that's the name that at least I'm more familiar with than the Catherine, but we can be formal if we need to be.
No, Katie's absolutely fine. That's what I go by.
Can you introduce yourself to the group?
Yes, happy to. I am an attorney here in Omaha, Nebraska. I have been practicing in civil litigation, which is trial work. I like to explain it to people that are familiar with the medical field as not every doctor is trained to be a surgeon. Only some are. Not every lawyer is trained to go to court. Only some are. I am one of those. And my specialty for the past 15 years has been medical malpractice defense work. So I represent hospitals, nurses, doctors. If you provide medical care, I have represented that specialty. So that's what I do day in and day out.
Well, we appreciate your work because unfortunately, people that provide healthcare get sued. And of course, that's where you come in. So that's what Katie's here to talk to us about today. So let me start with, I suppose, the obvious question. Why do patients and or their families sue hospitals and providers? What's the impetus? What's the reason?
On a very broad level, the reason is that they feel they have been wronged. And I will say that that is the vast majority of the lawsuits, is somebody feels that either they or their family member has been wronged by a medical provider. There are a small subset of lawsuits we see where it is simply someone just trying to win the lottery. They know they don't have a case. And I mean, they're really brought in bad faith because they want a quick paycheck. They very, very soon figure out this is not the way to get a quick paycheck. But by and large, very large scale view, someone feels that somebody in the medical community has wronged them.
So they've been harmed Or is it emotional harm? Is it physical harm most of the cases, or?
So that, I mean, it's interesting you say they have been harmed. Some have, some believe they have. Whether there's actual harm is a question in every case I have, but they all believe they have been harmed. Almost all of them believe they've had some physical harm as a result of the wrong committed on them. It is pretty typical for an attorney to also add into the case that they file against the medical provider that there is also some emotional harm, some pain and suffering, some fear. There's all sorts of components of what they can argue. They've lost enjoyment in their life, et cetera, et cetera. There's a long list of things they can claim are now wrong in their life because of some wrong a medical provider committed.
So are the number of lawsuits going up? I mean, is your desk packed full of cases, or are they fairly stable over time? It's the reason I'm asking is I don't think I go for an evening watching TV that I don't see multiple ads for call XYZ if you took this drug. It goes on and on. So is there an increasing number of lawsuits?
I can really only speak to what I'm seeing in Omaha, and I would say the number is pretty consistent in our region. What you're seeing on the TV is what we actually call multi-district litigation. Those are separate cases than what I deal with. Those are the asbestos cases, the tobacco cases, there's all sorts of them out there. I've actually been involved in some of them, but those are the products liability. I'm sure everyone's heard of the pelvic mesh cases. Those are called multi-district litigation cases. So those don't really take place in Omaha. They take place in courts across the country. I don't actually know if those are increasing. It seems like since I was a kid, there's been TV commercials asking you to call if you've taken something, used something. So I can't say I'm super familiar with that, but I would say in Nebraska, we're pretty stable.
Well, I guess that's a good sign. If we make mistakes, the patients understand. Is that a fair conclusion from that?
I think Nebraska is particularly unique because a lot of our providers are small town communities, and there is an inherent trust when you have a small town doctor and a small town feel about your medical care. The foundation for thinking that you have been wronged is a distrust in the medical care that was provided to you. And in small town Nebraska, they have these relationships with their medical providers where it's pretty difficult to break that trust. In larger cities, Nebraska only really has a handful, not even a couple, where the hospitals are very, very large and there's not a strong relationship between the patient and the provider always. It's easier to break that trust when you don't have that relationship. In other states where there's numerous large cities with large medical institutions, they're going to just see that psychological impact, that distrust sooner than they do in rural Nebraska.
Well, that's interesting because what I'm hearing, the theme, and perhaps I'm reading into it, is communication. You've known this provider your whole life. He came to deliver you in that whole thing. And so he's more than just a consultant at a large city hospital. So there's communication, trust, time, a number of those things. They've got to be part of the story.
They're a huge component of why lawsuits are filed. I can't say that doctors in rural Nebraska don't make mistakes. They certainly do. Every medical provider makes mistakes. No one's perfect. Are they going to get sued for it is the question.
And you're saying that it's less likely because you have a relationship with that provider. A little
correct.
More understanding on both sides. Yeah.
If your patients trust you, they feel that they've been informed by you, even when we have adverse outcomes, the relationship is strong enough that they don't feel this vendetta to sue you, or they saw it coming. That the adverse outcome was explained to them. They knew it was a risk. You see more communication with the small town providers who, appear to have all the time in the world and can meet with their patients and see their patients really regularly and consult on their patients in the hospital and take a seat in the hospital room and chit chat. They know their wives and their husbands and their kids. They go to church with them. There's better communication there. So even if we have an adverse outcome, either the family expected it or they're not as angry at the physician about it to the point where they're talking to a lawyer.
So that's a perfect segue to what we really want to get at today, and that's the issue of being sued over pressure injury development. And not just hospitals, but long-term care, clinics, emergency rooms, everybody, you know, is at risk of pressure injuries in various settings. It's not just in critical care. How often are pressure injuries the main focus of a lawsuit?
That is going to be in direct relationship to how many patients do we have that are at high risk of pressure injury. So in Omaha, Nebraska, we are not a state known for a lot of snowbirds and people who have relocated because they're getting older in age and don't want to live where it's cold. So you're going to see more pressure injury lawsuits along the coasts and down in the southern states, simply because the population most at risk for pressure injuries is the elderly population with several comorbidities. So you're going to see it on the coasts and down south. In the Midwest, we don't get that many.
Oh, that's an interesting assessment. I never thought about it geographically or by time of year. But you make a good point. If the high-risk population moves, their risk moves with them. So you brought up a statement a little bit ago about communicating and the patient knew this was coming or was told it might come. So in the hospital setting, you know, the patient is consented prior to surgery about all sorts of possible risks, you know, for example, wound infection after surgery. If that process was done with a patient and family over pressure injuries, would that be helpful or are we opening the door? So let me just give you a story so that you can respond to something. So I'm the staff nurse and I do my Braden score this morning. And based on the Braden score, I can tell that this patient's at high risk for the development of a wound on the heel because she broke her hip. If I go in and say to the patient, I'm concerned that you're not able to move your leg because of the pain and the fact that they just operated on it, concerned that you might get a bed sore, and I actually use that word, get a bed sore on your heel. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to lift your heel off the bed. I turn to the daughter and say, same thing. I'm concerned. And, you know, if you see your mom kick that pillow off, will you let me know? Is that helpful or are we telling too much to them?
The risk is there whether we tell them about it or not. I think it's always better to be honest and to communicate. So I know from my profession, the average education level is sixth grade, 12-year-old level of education and understanding. So I think even communicating to them, I'm concerned that your mom is going to get a bed sore. That's a start. You're talking to them about your concern. What we really need is if you're in their position and you don't know what a bed sore is, someone comes in and says to you, I'm concerned of your mom getting a pulmonary embolus. Well, if you don't know what that is, then you can't do anything to help. You don't really have an understanding of why. What can we be doing different? What can we be doing better? How do I minimize this risk? As the patient and the daughter, you're understanding the risk. You definitely want to do everything you can to minimize it. So they might need a better understanding of, I'm, you know, your WOCN or I'm your bedside nurse, whatever the role is. Here's what I'm looking at with you. I've done an evaluation. Some things I've noted are as follow, you know, you list out, you have a hard time turning. You're not eating very well. These are things that can really hurt your skin and we can get actual sores on our skin if we don't move enough, if we don't get the pressure off of our skin. So I am paying close attention to your heels and your butt, or whatever it is. we need to do it as best we can to get you off of those areas so that you don't get these sores. And here's what I'm going to put these boots on you. I'm going to put this pillow under you. And the daughter explained to her, that's why that's there. It might bother her. If it bothers her, please call me. We'll try to figure out something else, but we need to do everything we can to try to prevent these from happening. And then if the course of the patient goes a certain way where we can't turn them because they're hypotensive or something's going on, it's much easier to explain to the daughter, remember when we talked about me needing to turn your mom? Remember when we talked about this? Now we're in a predicament where I can't. So we're going to do everything we can to prevent it. But this may be something that we're dealing with in the future because we need to save your mom's life. And that's the priority. That is such a beneficial conversation to have with the patient and their family, because then when that pressure injury happens, guess what? They knew about it. They knew it was coming. It wasn't a surprise to them, and they don't automatically think someone dropped the ball.
I worked with a plastic surgeon a number of years ago who said to me, information given to the patient prior to something going wrong is called education. That same information given to the patient after something went wrong is an excuse. And I've never forgotten that. I mean, that's 45 years ago. And the emphasis was, just like you went through the story, tell them what you're thinking, tell them what you're doing. And that way, you know, you're kind of making them a participant in the care, you know, rather than a bystander, you're actually engaging them to help the mom. So I think that's really, really important. My sense is that some nurses would be afraid to do that because the sense is we're kind of opening Pandora's box and telling you all the things that could happen, that shouldn't happen, that might happen. And now you're on red alert, you know, and so have we boxed ourselves into a corner, but you're not seeing it that way.
I'm not seeing it that way. And I'm not saying that every patient that comes in and has a braided done needs to have this lecture. I think the nurses need to use critical thinking to decide, what's this Braden score? What is this person's risk? I mean, certainly if you're implementing boots or a turning schedule, if you're doing those things, the family should know and the patient should know what you're doing and why you're doing it. So if you have any condition that requires intervention, the patient has a right to know what you're doing and why. And that goes for anything, high blood pressure, diabetes. If you're giving them insulin, they have a right to know why and what it's doing. The same thing in my mind applies to turning and boots and, you know, low air loss mattresses. If you're using these things for them, because they're going to get a bill that says you used a Clinitron bed. Why did I need a Clinitron bed? Those are things that should be explained to them and educated. But again, like I said, the risk is there already. You educating them actually minimizes the risk of them coming back and saying, why'd you keep this a secret from me? You obviously didn't tell me because you knew you did something wrong or you were hiding something.
Different view. Lawyers tend to have a different view than I do most days. So I appreciate that view. It's an interesting conversation to think about what we do say to patients. Now, would you advise us to chart some of that conversation? How heavy do you rely on what we chart versus what we told you we did?
Most EMRs now have a separate subsection under plans of care, and it has in there the subnote or bullet point on educated family on pressure injury interventions. That's all I need. Hopefully you have educated them enough that that I will never have to read the chart, that they never sue you, that they don't feel that anybody did anything wrong. The chart shows me what you did. It should show me what you did. It should show me that you had the boots or the low air loss mattress or the nutrition consult. All of that's already in there. So I don't need you to reiterate that you did that and told the family about it. I'm more concerned about getting in front of the psychological part of it, that if the family knows this is going to happen and this is part of the process, they're less likely to get mad at you when it happens and then sue you.
Yeah, the more they know, the more they understand what we're doing. Yeah, it's very good. I'm not positive how often that happens. So when you look at a medical record, and let's say it's a pressure injury case occurring in a hospital, are there red flags that just stick out to you in the documentation? And if you could rattle off a couple, because everybody listening is going to say, oh, I just did that yesterday. So can you rattle off a few red flags?
I will say the biggest red flag in any pressure injury case is the pressure injury itself. Pressure injuries are never expected. So if we have one, we better have a good explanation for why. When I get a pressure injury case, I am identifying as close as I possibly can the time it was identified. Timing is so, so important. The time it was identified, and then based on the type of injury. So if it's a DTI, it's different than if it's a pressure injury. If it's a pressure injury, then I need to backtrack and figure out where was that patient in the 2 to 3 days before that. If I have, I'm looking for, were they in surgery? Were they found on the floor at home? Is it possible that they were in an MRI machine for a really long time? I'm looking for some explanation for why that injury is there. Otherwise, I'm looking for, were they hypotensive? Was there some kind of order to not turn them? If we have a patient that is capable of turning themselves and gets a pressure injury, that's a big question mark for me. How did that happen? Because I have to think it's immensely painful. So were they under anesthesia? What was going on in the 2 to 3 days before that, that I can say, this is why this happened? If I don't have a good explanation for why this happened, then we're in some hot water. So what I'm looking for is that explanation for why this happened. If I don't have a surgery or anesthesia or MRI or found on the floor at home, I don't know what any other reason for these to happen other than the person was not turned.
Well, would you, if you had, so a pressure injury shows up today, and you go back 3 days and you find that there's documented turning every 2 hours, just like clockwork, and the pressure injury occurs on the butt and the heels, then how do you tackle that?
That's a real problem, because either that charting is false, or they weren't sufficiently offloading pressure. Because there are, that's a training issue, is there are nurses who genuinely believe, and probably CMAs and LPNs who genuinely believe they are offloading appropriately. And so they're documenting turning Q2, turning routinely, but they're not actually sufficiently offloading. Even their either documentation says it, but the proof's in the pudding, really, is what it comes down to, is if you were sufficiently offloading and there's no other reason for this pressure injury, then we wouldn't have it. So pressure injuries are unique because there's very rarely, I don't know of any other reason they occur than pressure. So I either need an explanation for that pressure, or the pressure wasn't offloaded sufficiently. It's one of the two. And that's a training issue that we need to be training. I think a lot of facilities, what I'm seeing is a lot of facilities get these mattresses that they believe relieve them of all responsibility to turn the patient because the mattress does the work for them. Well, that's not the case. These mattresses do wonderful things, but they don't make it so that we don't have a responsibility to check on this patient and still make sure the offloading is sufficient. So that's what I'm looking for, is essentially, how did this happen and do I have a defense?
So you're looking for a reason to explain the outcome.
Well, the reason is pressure. I'm looking for, why is the pressure there?
Yeah, I didn't say that very well, did I? You're looking for an event that explains the outcome, that they couldn't be turned in an MRI machine, or nobody knew they were on the kitchen floor. That's the triggering event is out of the control of the provider, is what you're telling me.
Correct.
That's a great way to do it, I think. I think it's a really good way, because then you've got the story nailed down. So the last question I have for you is the person who is told what to do and refuses to let us do it. Sometimes we call them non-compliant. The more polite term is to call them non-adherent. And then they sue us when they get a pressure injury because they wouldn't turn when they were supposed to. I know you can sense the frustration in my voice. Help us. What do we do with that?
Non-compliant patients are complex because we have two subsets. We have the non-compliant patients who are mentally sound and are capable of making those decisions for themselves. And then we have the non-compliant patient with dementia, Alzheimer's, who really is not in a position to make that decision for themselves. In the mentally competent patient, that is a situation where you're likely going to have to go up the chain of command. If they're not listening to you, you can't just wipe your hands of it and say, not my problem. I've told you, you're not listening. You are going to be cross-examined on, isn't it your job to advocate for this patient? Don't you realize this patient was going through a lot? It was a very stressful event in their lives. They didn't understand the risks of not turning. They weren't explained well enough. You will get attacked for washing your hands of it. So the best course of action is to talk to the resident, talk to the attending, talk to the charge nurse, see who else you can get involved. If it's a newly para or new quad, maybe it's psych that needs to get involved. Maybe they need a psych consult to talk about all of the changes in their life and the importance of not further deteriorating their situation by their mental block. So if it depends on the patient, but it is unlikely to be satisfactory to just wash your hands of it and say, you're non-compliant. I think you're safer getting a second or third or fourth person involved. And ultimately, if we have a few different people trying and the patient is still not compliant, then it's all of you basically signing off and saying, we've educated, we've told, we're all witnesses to it. Really easy to defend for me. The demented patient, that one, we can't write that the demented patient is not adherent. They don't have the capacity to adhere anyway. If they are adherent, I would honestly consider it a fluke. They are demented. So if they're not listening to instruction, you absolutely have to go to the family, to the higher ups in the facility, to the primary care provider. We have to get more people involved in that discussion because we cannot wash our hands of a demented or mentally unsound or mentally incompetent person. They can't make that choice legally. So we must go up the chain.
Tough problems to deal with. I appreciate your thought on that. Well, thank you for joining us for this edition of the NPIAP podcast. Let me thank my guest today, Catherine Cheadle, an attorney who does medical malpractice defense. So as you could hear, she has some pretty good understanding about the science and the care of patients at risk for pressure injuries. Let me also thank Courtney Smith for being the master behind the drape of getting this thing running, and the University of Nebraska at the College of Nursing for hosting this. I'll see you next time on NPIAP's podcast.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. That was a very engaging and amazing topic. Thank you so much to our guest and co-host. And thank you for your attention in learning more about this very important issue. That's all we have for today on RN Huddle. Be sure to tune in next time. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to RN Huddle. To stay connected, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at UNMCCNE or check out unmc.edu/CNE for more program information.